This is Luke Allison with CriticalBench.com, and I'm here with Kelly Starrett. Kelly, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. I wanted to sort of do something a little different. You're involved with a lot of things, and I wasn't exactly sure how to pin that down. So if you meet someone for the first time, how do you explain to them what you do?
Right, which is a good question. Specifically, if I was sitting on the airplane seat and you asked me what my job was, I would say I'm a strength coach and I'm a physio, and I specialize in kind of finding the inefficiencies and kind of power saps and power bleeds in athletes. We find it basically, I've kind of been able to, lucky enough to work with a huge kind of, you know, cross-section of people and been able to kind of start to understand the similarities I've got a dog squeaking toy in the background. I specialize in kind of seeing where athletes are giving away power and typically how that, leads to dysfunction. Sometimes it's the dysfunction that, or pain or problem that kind of initiates the conversation, but ultimately it's about how do we get more poundage, wattage, output. That's what it's about.
And I noticed that you come from a pretty interesting or at least unique background. You did a lot of rowing and paddling. You were an athlete, and you've also been involved with coaching. What has that been like?
Well, I'll tell you what. I used to paddle slalom, whitewater slalom, which is basically akin to standing in a cold shower and ripping up $20 bills. It's an esoteric kayaking sport. What's important about that is I had a chance to paddle professionally. I was kind of in the old dogma of, you know, we paddled 11 to 13 times a week. The cross training wasn't very good. The nutrition wasn't very good. And subsequently, I was injured. And, I quit racing because my hand was numb and cortisone didn't work and prednisone didn't work. And, you know, I was asking all the athletes around me, you know, what is this normal? Does this happen? You know, all the old national team guys, and they were all like, oh, yeah, this always happens. In fact, we were looking around and starting to see, you know, I happened to notice that every girl on the national team when I was racing there had shoulder surgery, every single woman. In fact, they were like, oh, yeah, if you're a woman on the national team, chances are you're going to have shoulder surgery, 100%. And that was really kind of the beginning of putting the pieces together that, like, what do you mean? Like, something is broken here. Why are athletes getting injured squatting? Why are we, you know, why are so many broken runners? Where's the kind of disconnect there? So, it's nice to have come from a background where you understand what it's like to try to put together a life as a competitive athlete, and then, you know, what it's like to be injured and how crippling that is, and then now on the other side to see how simple it is to kind of prevent those overuse injuries, to recognize the inefficiencies of athletes and keep them in the field or in their sports longer. You know, more and more we're finding that it takes a long time to become really, really good at your game. I mean, look at some of our best athletes in their, you know, 20s, late 20s, early 30s. Some of the operators that we work with, you know, the SEALs and the Forces guys, it takes a long time to be really, really competent. And, one of the goals now is if we can avoid, you know, injury, if we can put off tissue dysfunction by focusing on performance, then we can get guys in the NFL longer. We can keep guys, you know, at the top of their games longer because it takes a lifetime to get good at these sports.
There seems to be competing ideas about whether it's more beneficial to have coaches that have participated in the sports that they coach or coaches that come from, you know, some sort of a pedagogical background or like a sports psychology background. Is that something that you feel comfortable weighing in on?
Well, I tell you, I think there's good coaching wherever that comes from. And certainly, you know, in some of these very, very technical sports, you know, having grown up and around them, it takes a lifetime to collect the information and skill set and familiarity to, you know, be a platform coach. At the same time, you know, I think that this kind of old model of having one coach that ended up being the resource, the sole resource for, you know, all things related to the health and wellness and, you know, and satisfaction and success of the athlete, I think that's the broken model. And you know, when we see one of the things that we specialize in our gym is that we work with, you know, athletes, lots of different athletes. And I think that it's that, you know, disparate cross-section that's dynamic that allows us to see patterns and similarities and pick up things that we might not see if we only worked with Olympic lifters or we only worked with power lifters or just worked with runners. And at the same time, you know, it's nice to be able to say, hey, I'm not interested in, you know, programming. That's between you and your coach. You know, how we manage my goal is then to walk in and say, what are the missing pieces? How do we get more out of your programming? How are you giving away force and production? And so many times, as you can experience, and I'm sure the listeners can experience, you know, your coach gives you a really crappy nutrition, you know, plan. Or, you know, we have really technical rowing coaches who are fantastic and are world champs and all these things, but can't necessarily program strength and conditioning. So, you know, finding people who are really good and kind of creating a community and a cross-section, I think, is the real strength. And you know, even if you look at, you know, the content of Critical Bench, for example, or, you know, any good kind of strength and conditioning community, you're trying to bring in lots of voices that understand that there's a great deal of mutual accommodation between systems, but that, you know, it's better to find experts who understand what you're doing and can assist in what you're doing than trying to be one person doing it all. Is that a fair enough answer?
Absolutely. It sounds like that sort of begins to lay the foundation for why you transitioned into physical therapy. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I remember being a young national team kid and literally having a conversation with an Olympic, reigning Olympic gold medalist about what to eat for breakfast. He's like, you know, I just don't feel like my breakfast works. You know, and you're like, you're the best in the world. You know, and weak, and, you know, and having shoulder problems. And, you know, I sometimes, you know, when we tap into the communities of the people with just unreal genetics, you know, and who've come through good programs early on, they've been vetted, they have the muscle memory, the control, the long-time training, and they're genetic freaks, you know, when you see those big holes like that, it's easy to walk through. And you know, and the advantage then for the rest of us mortals is that, you know, we can kind of distill down away from, okay, I'm never going to have that genetic freakness, that quality, comma, what are the best practices? And then, you know, how do we do that? And more importantly, you know, I think we're really having a conversation about is how do we build complete athletes? How do we empower athletes to know what's going on, to be empowered to take care of their business, to recognize their bad positioning, to understand that, you know, boy, you got to be hydrated, you got to watch your nutrition, you got to watch your inflammation if the details and margins are smaller and smaller. You know, the difference between, you know, first place and gold medal and world champion and, you know, fifth or tenth is, you know, tiny. It's a few pounds, it's a few kilos, it's a few wattages, it's a few seconds. And, you know, I think we've seen a lot more kind of growing sophistication and growing, you know, with the kind of advent of the internet community. You know, people are sharing ideas, and, you know, lots of cars are going really fast now, and people have figured out really quickly. I mean, you know, my mom knows what West Side conjugate training is. You know, that's really weird, you know, and
nice.
And she eats gluten-free and takes the stinky distilled oil from a weird Arctic fish, you know, like, that's weird. And so if my mom is doing that and my wife is doing that and even my daughter knows, you know, what to eat and what not to eat, then, you know, we've got to pay attention to all these details. And so when we see athletes giving away huge amounts of force and not even knowing it, then that's a failure of kind of our system or coaching. And, you know, what we're trying to do is just, you know, I don't think we know what's possible yet as human beings. We're going to get there. The details are getting smaller and smaller, but, you know, that I think that's what's at stake.
Now, I wanted to ask sort of why physical therapy. Obviously, there are a lot of different avenues if you're interested in sort of sports performance. I mean, you could have become, you know, a medical doctor with residency, sort of research and biochemistry and things like that. Why did you choose what you did?
Well, such a fair question. And if you've had the experience of, you know, inept physical therapy or bad chiropractic or, you know, bad, you know, whatever rehab model, you know, certainly you'd think, hey, going into physical therapy isn't the key. I chose my school because it specialized in this Australian approach to manual therapy, which is a kind of this very hardcore, you know, hands-on, very manual approach. And when I saw that, it was this kind of heavy-duty, manual, physical contact, movement-based approach, and it really jived with what I understood as an athlete. And what I realized was that, as you know, as a competitor, et cetera, I had never gotten what I needed from the physios that I was working with, and I saw that there was a better way to kind of integrate these things. And I think the real, you know, I've recently come up with this idea of, like, this is the way that I would recommend you find a physician, you find a physical therapist, you find someone. If someone's, because we get asked this question all the time, like, how do I know this is a good physical therapist or doctor? And I'm like, the answer is you ask them how much they deadlift, straight up. And, you know, I think the problem is that we haven't had enough, you know, physio strength coaches. We haven't enough strength coach physios out there. So when I saw the interface between, hey, movement, effectiveness, heavy lifting, athleticism, and then really understanding that there was a kind of a real interplay between what I could accomplish as a physio by, you know, changing tissue position, changing joint position, better integration, better organization of the athlete manually, it was just like a no-brainer. And, you know, it felt like, you know, I was the only physio out there, you know, picking up heavy things, and which, of course, is not the case, but we're finding out more and more that, you know, it's a real nice way to kind of see the world. And I think physical therapists have a unique training background or you know, education background that they can potentially apply in a more effective way. More importantly, if you are Olympic lifting and training and running and sprinting, you can really understand what the mechanics are, and then you have this really great tool set and theoretical legitimacy to be able to teach people how to manage themselves. And we have just failed people miserably in that someone, you know, you can squat 800 pounds, you know, you can, you're Mark Bell and you can bench 900 pounds, and lo and behold, you know, turns out you're missing a little extra rotation and flexion. And, you know, why did you have to go see your doctor? Not that he's done this, but, you know, why did, when you have knee pain, can you not deal with your knee pain? You have to go see your physician. Your physician sends you to a physical therapist, doesn't understand what you're doing. And all along, you know, you just have tight anterior hip, you know, your quads are really short, you got bad mechanics. And if you could address those things or be able to perform the basic maintenance on yourself, you know, you cut out 19 different steps, you know, and you go faster. You know, so I think that's the real issue is that, you know, being a physio, I found that I could be in a position to, you know, show athletes how to treat themselves and, more importantly, how to get more out of their training because, man, we are just inefficient.
I think that's a good explanation of an improvement. You know, I think a lot of people's experience is probably pretty similar to what you described, where they go to a orthopedic surgeon and an orthopedic surgeon wants to cut on things with an arthroscope, and that's not really what a lot of people want to do, so they're looking for anything else, usually.
Well, that's right, and, you know, it's not the surgeon's fault. When you've worn a hole in your kneecap because you've got bad mechanics, let's just say, you know, your quads are tight, you're overextended, you've got this neurogenic, you know, clamping down of your muscles, or just your calves are tight, you're wearing, you know, you get early compression in your knees, you have crap hip mobility, and suddenly you've worn a hole in your kneecap, right? Well, imagine that you go see your doctor, and the doctor's like, dude, you got to stop squatting. And you're like, hell no, I'm not going to stop squatting. Like, I'm the best. This is what, you know, you can't keep me down. What the physician is really saying is, hey, I've noticed you've worn a hole in your kneecap and doing what you're doing, and that's got to stop. You've herniated your discs. You've broken your back.
Right.
You know, we can help you, comma, I don't know what to do to change the mechanics, right? And that's where we're starting to see the interface. And, you know, and athletes are sophisticated. We're much more sophisticated than we were, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago is the dark ages. I mean, not that guys weren't brutally strong 10 years ago, but what we're seeing now is that, you know, people are, you know, they're smart about how they train and the drugs we use and how we recover. I mean, in some of my seminars, I ask them, like, how many people have taken an ice bath in the last week? And, you know, 50% of the hands go up. I mean, that's insanity. And, you know, we're getting smarter about taking care of these details. By the time you've, you know, worn a hole in your knee or destroyed your labrum in your shoulder or torn your rotator cuff, you've literally had to wake up every day and be like, today's the day. I'm going to end my rotator cuff today. You know, you're designed as a human being to be pain-free. You're designed as a human being to be ridden hard and put away wet. And, you know, at the same time, so by the time something has popped its head up and that you're having pain and dysfunction, you've had to work really hard at it. And with the poundages and the wattages and the outputs that people are doing, what we're seeing now, I see more and more, is that, you know, guys and gals are, when they develop a speed wobble, it's not a big deal when they were doing 10 miles an hour, but now they're doing 150 miles an hour, and that speed wobble, you know, causes the wheel to fly off. And that's why the details really start to matter more and more.
Because that's well beyond the conscious part that you can correct. That's
well,
all.
Well, and right, and I mean, look at any of the sports that we're all interested in, right? I mean, you bring up rowing. You know, we work with a lot of rowers. Pain buttons, broken. They just don't feel pain. They suffer. That's what happens. You know, look, take it any strength athlete and the intense suffering and soreness that goes along with, you know, that sport. And, you know, it's difficult for us to, you know, critically assess, am I brutally sore? Am I doing damage? You know, and the issue is that it's really easy to see. And what's really important for athletes to understand is that issues of mobility and position, issues of tissue health and safety are really issues of performance. And that when we get the athlete in the most organized way, we eliminate shear, we eliminate early compression, we optimize all the joint health, all the things that theoretically we should care about, we go faster. And if we focus on the performance first, that's how we know the other stuff works. Why should I care about your hip mobility? Well, not because you theoretically may or may not herniate a disc. It's because if we open up your hip mobility, man, your poundage goes up, your wattage goes up. And that's how we know it works. And so we've taken, you know, this issue of some theoretical ideal of how much range of motion I need to saying, hey, what compromises are you not consciously making or are you unconsciously making? And then we change your hip position, we get you into a better position, and we can see that change not in some, you know, qualitative, you know, thing, but in a quantitative change in wattage and power and et cetera, et cetera. You know, we work with really good cyclists, and what do they care about? Men, you know, they care about wattage. And so if we can demonstrate we get them into a better position, they go faster. That's what speaks. And at the same time, you know, my physical therapist itself is like, hey, I've protected that knee, I've protected that back, now I got that athlete going. But the only thing we should ever care about is hot, dirty, nasty performance. And that's what we've failed to do. Let me give you an example. Imagine if you were, you know, everyone knows they should floss their teeth, right? Do you floss?
Sure.
Did you floss? And you're like, well, I know I should floss. And the reason you should floss is you don't want to lose your teeth, maybe theoretically in 20 years, right? But what if I said if you flossed your teeth, you'd put 40 pounds on your deadlift? You know, you'd set a world record. You'd floss obsessively. And the key is that we have never taken issues of joint positioning, you know, joint mobility, tissue health, tissue supability, and framed it in the context of things that are important to athletes. You know, power, wattage, performance, you know, recovery. You know, we've always said, hey, we'll wait till you're injured or you're having a problem. Now we triage that instead of saying, how do we optimize the athlete? How do we prevent force from being bled? How do we keep athletes, you know, in the field longer and competing longer? And that is the shift that's starting to happen. And I think people are getting it. We really are getting it. You know, we started Mobility Wad as a, you know, kind of as a love note and a love poem, you know, just to give athletes a jump start. You know, we're at like, you know, 1.5 million visits. I mean, it's insane. You know,
wow.
Obviously we didn't know where to start with this thing. And then, you know, people are smart enough that they start to get it and they remember the things that work and that it takes so little input that, you know, if you're going to obsess about what you eat and how do you train and you fly out and train with this coach and take a room full of athletes and you're like, how many people in here have watched an internet lifting video in the last 24 hours? You know, it's 90% of the ants. I mean, that's weird.
Sure.
And obsessive, you know?
Yeah.
So showing someone how they can open their hips in 5 minutes, I mean, that's no big deal, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to sort of transition a little bit, but there's a tendency to view weight training through the lens of whatever sport we participate in. And I'm curious if that's the only way to orientate ourselves or if there's another way, possibly.
Well, you know, I think we're smart enough now and savvy enough now that hopefully people are moving away from, you know, seeing weight training as kind of some theoretical thing, 8 sets of 3 to 10 reps thing that they need to do it's a really excellent way to develop power and facilitate strength and, you know, build field strength. And, you know, it's interesting when a lot of times there's a lot of discussion that gets sidetracked, I think, when we're talking about the nuances of, you know, what's the best way to train an elite powerlifter? What's the best way to train an Olympic lifter? You know, how much metabolic conditioning do they need? You know, is it too much volume? How much are you, you know, when we're talking about the weight training for, you know, for the athlete, if we're looking at how do we use strength conditioning for actual sports that don't include just the weight training, then, you know, almost anything works because, you know, what ends up happening is that you can use any one of these movements as movement screens. You know, you don't have to do perform movement screen. Like, I can tell a lot about you as soon as I watch you deadlift, as soon as I watch you squat, as soon as I watch you press, I'm pretty much going to know who you are and where you fail. But more importantly is that, as you know as a coach, that as soon as you get your hands on an Olympic rower and you throw them into a push-up and you throw them into a press or you – you know, there are just glaring holes, and it's a lot more simple than I think people realize. You know, it almost doesn't matter, and more importantly, I think if it's a question about, you know, programming, then, you know, what we're interested in is the system that works, and I think a lot of systems work. How do we get our athletes to perform enough work where they see commensurate change in output and wattage? And, you know, that's the thing that matters. You know, one of our athletes on the national rowing team, she's a world champion, Olympic medalist, set American history last season, or season before, winning the first gold medal in the pair, et cetera, phenomenal athlete. She's working on some, you know, we got her doing some triples on squatting, and she was a little bit bummed out that she hadn't made progress on her triples between testing. And yet she had PR'd on a 6K rowing test by 12 seconds. And
wow.
A lifetime PR. And so she was really disappointed because she felt like she wasn't getting stronger. We were excited because, you know, she wasn't getting weaker. She was showing performance gains in the things that she needed to be showing performance gains in. And she, you know what I mean, she's able to buffer all that training. So, you know, I think it's got to be about outputs. And, you know, and then pretty much it all works at some point, you know. The issue is then what specifically are you doing? Man, you got to get people pulling wide. You got to keep people box squatting. You know, we get in our little dogmas. Is it high bar? Is it low bar? It's squatting, and you need to keep mixing it up, you know?
This is sort of weird, and I want to try real hard not to geek out for a second here. But one of the thoughts that came up was I don't know that I trust people or myself to sort of self-select their sport. And what comes to mind is the Russian process, the process of attaining sports mastery, where basically kids did gymnastics and coordination and proprioception and things like that, and then a coach said, you do this at like 12 or 13. What do you think about something like that?
Well, first of all, I have two daughters, right? And my wife is a two-time world champion whitewater paddler, and she was a national champion and was a rower cow. So, you know, like, you know, you inherit your mitochondria from your mother. So my kids can suffer. Like, they're just going to be, you know, they can suffer. And they have some, you know, they move well, and they're involved in these gymnastics programs. And, you know, what's interesting probably is that when you put the right framework on kids and you give them the education and you teach them to squat and to jump and to run, which are all technical skills, and they do gymnastics, and they do kind of body wear control stuff, then chances are, and they have good genetics, right?
Sure.
Any sport you put them in, they're probably going to be successful in, given that they like it, they're motivated by it, they have good coaching. You know, if you talk to a lot of people, I mean, let's take John Wellborn, NFL, 10-year player, you know, CrossFit football guy. You know, like, he was a monster early on. You know, and when he was playing Little League football and into high school, his mom would ask him every day, every meal, do you want two pancakes or three? You know, so he ate two or three pancakes every meal trying to be big. And pretty soon it was, you know, he kind of self-selected, strong kid, very motivated, very interested, good coaching, you know, turns out to be, you know, an NFL monster, right? Then the question is really like, how do you prepare child, teen athletes to be successful and in any sport that they choose, and how do you set them up so that we just don't grind them down, so these kids aren't just destroyed? Because I think underneath what you're hearing is, you know, I like paddling, I like, you know, certain these other things, but how do I prepare my daughters to make the choices and give them the physical education that really kind of sets them up to make the decisions that they want to make, you know? And, you know, one of the, I think, the really interesting things that's happening is we're seeing more and more really good local centers of strength conditioning. There are 22,000 CrossFits and lots of strength coaching. You know, really good strength coaches in there. Super training is really close to us. You know, I can go train with Mike Bergner. You're out on the East Coast, and you find Zach Evanesh, and you're like, holy crap. So there's all these really amazing centers. And imagine suddenly now there's this return to how do we make, you know, generally physically prepared kids? How do we, you know, have this kind of Soviet-style feeder program that creates super athletes, then that, you know, kids can find? Because, I mean, if you're Sage Bergner or you're, you know, one of Mike Bergner, Olympic lifting superstar, you know, my mentor Mike Bergner's kids, chances are you're just going to grow up around Olympic lifting and it's natural and that's what happens and, you know, you're already self-selected for it. So, you know, is it impossible to, you know, program for a kid? I'll tell you that my daughter Georgia got a javelin for her fourth birthday. She has gymnastics and she does dance and, you know, we're starting with jiu-jitsu here and then, you know, she's 5 and a half. So, you know, what's that look like? I think it's the classic education in physics, in fitness that I think we all wish we had and probably didn't have.
Sure, definitely. I want to see if I can try to bridge a gap that I'm seeing forming here. There was an episode of the Mobility Wad. It was 63. It was October of last year. Talked about a couple things that I want to maybe expand on a little bit. Talked about no days off, so doing something every 24 hours, small aggregate pieces, and then you mentioned, again, the 11 to 13 workouts per week while you were on the paddling national team.
Well, so let's pull that first piece on, you know, and that, you know, there's this, I think we either it's a type 1 thinking error or we're not organized in our thinking or we're not paying attention, but, you know, off days of training, when we say there are no days off, I think what I'm saying, what we're trying to say is that recovery is more important than, you know, the training stimulus. You know, the person who can perform the most work and be the freshest wins every time. And so when I say there can't be any days off, that means on your day off, it's mobility. You're out maybe pulling the sled. You've dialed your nutrition in perfectly. You know, you don't sit at your desk 19 hours a day and close your hips down and end up dehydrated and behind, and you fell behind on your nutrition. And, you know, there just can't be that error that as we start to pay attention more and more to the details of what really elite performance is and how we're going to really reset what's possible as human beings now with all the modern training, you know, GNCs down the street and the fact that, you know, everyone has chains and bands and is doing all this crazy training. How do we kind of manage that? And one of the ways we manage it is that you have to absolutely be thinking, you know, you can't be sloppy on the off days. And that every single time that you and I are training, to, you know, for world championships, the guy who's, you know, thinking about the details more obsessively is likely going to win. I work with some really, really good cyclists, and you know, they have these, you know, the details, they monitor their sleep quality with these head things. They, you know, they use these special mouth guards that have them, you know, sleep in a better jaw position. They use these high compression devices that compress all the swelling and tissue out of their legs. And they're sort of mini obsessed with these details that allow them to go out and train that hard. So that's the first rule, I think, was saying, you know, the 11 to 13 workouts a week, could I handle that much training? Yes, until I couldn't, until my body fell apart because I wasn't doing the things that I needed to do to support that. My nutrition wasn't as good as it is now. I didn't strength train as effectively as I do now, and I couldn't see the things that I was missing, and no wonder my hand went numb. I mean, I deserved that. You know, I was just a mess. I was a hot mess. So, you know, Floyd Landis, who is that great cyclist, really, he said, you know, whoever trains the hardest wins. And someone's like, what about overtraining? And he's like, well, if you overtrained, then you obviously didn't train hard enough to be able to train that hard. See rule number one. And, you know, I think that's the key, is that how do we, you know, get enough stimulus? And we're volume happy over here. You know, how do we get enough stimulus to get good results and not enough more, right?
One of the things that I think comes up again is, okay, say you're getting 6 to 8 workouts a weekend, And maybe it matters what your sport is, maybe it doesn't. But it seems like the only way to really pick up those other, you know, 5 to 6 workouts is either specific sports preparedness or some kind of skill work. Does that seem correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, so there is some notions, I think, sometimes in training communities where, you know, you don't have to do your sport if you're, you know, well-conditioned in the gym or, you know, I mean, if you take, some of those workouts are, you know, very skill-based. And, I think the idea kind of gets convoluted a little bit when you think about, weightlifting. The Romanians, you know, train twice a day and the Chinese change, you know, it's heavy every single, you know. But, this is the art of coaching, of course. And then having athletes that are prepared enough and are not working at the margins of their capacities in terms of tissue tolerance, you know, low back, you know, stiffness, whatever. So that if you've prepared athletes enough, then they can, you know, when we're talking about the highest levels, you know, my rowers are going to do 2 workouts a day, no matter what. And maybe with, you know, some of our girls, we do 3 workouts a day. But that third workout, it's 20 minutes. It's a recovery piece, or we get them on the water, and it's a technique session that doesn't tax them. You know, but, you know, you're absolutely right. I think it has to be that sport-specific stuff. And it's not necessarily all of that heavy, heavy, gnarly, gnarly end-range training because, you know, we all know people who've just augured in. You know, and it's, you know, it's always a surprise. I don't know what happened. I just just caught this flu, you know. I just got crushed. What happened? My knee blew up. And, you know, you're like, well, you've been setting yourself up for that for 3 weeks now. You're into a hard training cycle. Is that a fair enough answer?
No, absolutely. I'm trying to develop something which I think is probably beyond my grasp, but I'm working really hard. You know, I see a lot of people, they're in the gym, they're busting their ass, they're in there 3 or 4 days a week. But what I think I'm realizing is that it's simply not enough. There's no way that you can work hard enough in those amount of sessions to sort of rise above. It's like, yeah, you can, you know, maybe stave off heart disease or something like that, or hypertension, whatever. But you're not really going to start outperforming people.
No.
And I'm not sure what the, you know, sort of where the movement is, because it seems like you're talking about building communities. It's like, well, I'm not in high school. I'm not doing power cleans with the football team anymore. You know, so it's like, how are we as individuals sort of recreating these communities?
Sure. Well, you know, I think the first thing is that, you know, it's difficult to train alone and try to do this by yourself without a coached environment. And so getting a coach or some coaching of some kind really is, that's tricky. You know, and if you're not coaching, then working, obsessively working with different coaches when you can, you know, trying to create that atmosphere of like a coached environment. I think it was Louis Simmons who said, I've been coached with every set of squats I've ever done my whole life, ever. You know, Olympic lifters create Olympic lifting teams and clubs. You know, super training has a, you know, if you want to train with them, if you want to train with Mark Bell, all you have to do is show up and bust your ass. You know, I think there's a lot of that sort of thing there. And, you know, the question is, you know, it's that law of diminishing returns. Maybe it used to be that, you know, Jim Schmitz trained some really, really strong national champions in Olympic lifting 3 days a week. And it was, you know, 2.5 hours, 3 days a week. And that was enough with his program that then with the genetics. But, you know, probably chances are you can make good gains. But if you're talking about, you know, really being the best athlete on the planet in your sport, it's probably going to take more than 3 to 4 days a week. It's probably 6 days a week, but some of those are little mini workouts. You know, we completely advocate for the home gym. You know, you have to have a full setup at home, and it doesn't take much. Some bumpers, you know, you can get a great squat rack from Rogue or, you know, York Fitness, you know, a real simple squat cage. You know, you don't need the best bar in the world. And, you know, I think it sets you up for, you know, being able to have that programming option, you know, to be able to kind of get that. You know, we have a sled and a tire we drag up and down the street in front of our house, you know, and how do you get those little details in? You know, I think a lot of really good programs have moved towards, let's have more frequent, more intense sessions that the athlete can recover from. You know, I mean, you know, Louis guys in and out in the gym in an hour plus around, you know, that's pretty badass. You know, the whole, you know, I think there's a lot of models there where we can get our athletes moving effectively in and out of the gym, warmed up, and then take that mobility piece, that's 10 minutes in front of the TV. You know, let's take something else, and, you know, your nutrition is another workout kind of idea. And, you know, I think that's what's happened. And if you look at, you know, the weightlifting communities, the number of blogs, I mean, if you can't find a community that support you and you're not seeing progress, then ask what's up. Because, you know, as long as you're making good gains, the question is, you know, what's enough gains? Are you in the right place? But as long as you're moving forward, it's working.
Progress is the key.
Idea.
Yeah,
that's right.
Absolutely. There were two ideas, and not necessarily questions. I thought about, as soon as you can afford something, then they give it to you for free. The idea of being a resident athlete, like at the Olympic Training Center. It's like, well, you have food, you have accommodations, you have free body work, then you're taken care of. Then it's like, well, I'm working and I'm training real hard and I'm trying to get there. But then when I make it, then I have all of those things taken care of. So it's this weird dichotomy. Is that anything that you have experience with?
Well, you know, I think that we have some kind of notion of a theoretical utopia where we train, you know, and maybe
sure.
That happens one time in your life. But I'll tell you, I know a lot of world champions who are grad students, work hard, you know, are police officers, you know, can still be really good. They just have to work around it. They're strength conditioning coaches, you know, they're working coaches. And I think what's nice now is that, you know, if you eat clean, boy, there's Whole Foods on the corner, and you can probably eat better yourself than you can if someone cooked dinner for you, you know. And I think that there's a romantic notion of being a monk athlete, but I think, you know, the more robust athletes have normal lives, they have relationships, they train around their children. You know, I think it's possible to kind of have that, you know. You know, and I tell you what, having health insurance and not being critically poor and having to send your picture of the power bar sticker on your helmet to the power bar to get your $20, you know, that's a terrible life. You know, I just think that the training is so efficient now that you can kind of do all of those things without having to kind of, you know, hit some magical thing and arrive there. Maybe it's just because I'm on the other side and I'll never be great at anything ever again, comma. You know, but, you know, I think we do it better at our gym than you could get at the Olympic Training Center, except for the national level team coaching. You know, you're going to get the strength and conditioning coaching, and there are places where people can find this. You're going to get the physio. You're going to get the nutrition stuff. And now you're free to move around the country and do what you need to do. And if you want to go do a camp at the Olympic Training Center, that's great.
I think it's just a matter of, you know, like you said, what's your utopia? What's your idea? What gets you out of bed? What gets, you know, the 12 sessions a week done? You know, what are those sort of switches that you flip every
well,
so
and
often?
It's I think it's hard work. You know, and if anyone's known who, you know, if you're just a, you know, recreational strength athlete, like, it's hard work. You know, and you know. You're eating, potentially getting up in the middle of the night to eat and managing these details, and it's hard. And we have a ton of recreational Olympic lifters around us who are very serious. They're passionate, it's their hobby. You know, we have a lot of, you know, recreational rowers around us who will kind of obsess over these details. And, you know, are you making progress? Are you not making kind of those type one errors that, you know, you're giving a lot away and a lot of your training inefficiency away? And I think as long as those two kind of, you know, precepts or concepts are met, then you're going to be okay. You know, if the best, you know, coach in the world is the resident coach at the Olympic Training Center, well, I guess you're going to have to go figure out a way to be there, you know, or be, at least move there, around there, you know, for the sacrifice thing. You know, I think that there's just, the internet has just given us, you know, carte blanche for understanding what the best in the world are doing. What does that really mean to me as a, you know, stay-at-home dad, you know? My wife's an attorney, and, you know, I have three kids, and, you know, you just get the idea as the metaphor. You know, there is a way to train effectively. Even just if you look at the New York Times or Wall Street Journal just did that article about the divorce rates amongst endurance athletes. Oh my God. I mean, it's just hard for people to, you know, do 5 hours of running, and, you know, that's the compromise you're going to make.
Right. It's difficult to have it all as you begin to sort of walk your own path and whatnot. To pull back for a second, get a little bit less serious. Do you feel like there's a danger that you might actually make physical therapy cool?
No, no way.
No chance.
Cool, but sexy again.
Okay.
Well, and the reason is, you know, what I hope to do is invent toilet paper, and you know that everyone needs toilet paper. And what I've done, hopefully, is show people that, you know, the basic concepts of ideal joint position, good setup, you know, minimizing shear your meniscus is the way to go faster. And, you know, God forbid, you know, we ever empower our athletes. I'm starting to get athletes who come to me now who are like, hey, Kelly, you know, I've worked upstream and downstream of the problem. I tried to mobilize the capsule. I don't think this is a sliding surface problem, and I'm pretty sure I'm organized. What do you think it is? You know, and as a physio, I'm like, that's amazing. Like, we can get some work done, you know? Like, that's an enlightened athlete. You know, I'm managing my inflammation. I'm not dehydrated. You know, I've got good tissue health. You know, what do you think it is? You know, I've been icing obsessively. And at that point, you know, you can just – so many things are taken off the table. And, that you know, that's an athlete who understands how to get into a good position, how to recover, what to do to mobilize to improve their position. And that's what's happened, you know, and I'll tell you, people have been very, very generous, only in so much, I think, is that they've gotten good results and they've seen improvements in their power. You know, if you take someone's pain away, that's great, and they remember that. But if you get them a PR, you know, you're their god, with a little G, of course. But, I mean, that's what we're doing. You know, how do we flip this on its head and say, look, I should not be the only arbiter and the resource. Your physio down the street shouldn't be the guy who's saying, like, why don't you just, you know, put a lacrosse ball in your butt and roll around on it? Like, what, you know, why is that voodoo? Why should that cost you $150 for a session?
Great questions. I'm not entirely sure I would have the answer to that, but it's worth working towards, certainly.
Well, it's hard to be an expert in everything, right? It really is hard to be an expert. And, you know, the project of the mobility wad is, you know, I think people can, they got enough psychic energy for a 4 to 6 minute lesson a day, and they can do 10 minutes of stretching. You know, I learned something when, you know, my wife, who is the best athlete in the family, you know, we're always, you know, kind of having this bickering. I'm like, dude, you got to be taking care of your tight hips. She's like, I just want to lay here and stretch. You stretch me. And like, that's not how it works. And, you know, we'd get in these fights, these mini fights. And the one day I came in, you know, we've been doing the mobility wad for like, you know, 2 weeks or something. And I came home and I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, I'm doing the mobility wad. She's like, it's just right there. It's totally easy. I understand it. I'm like, hon, you filmed me in doing the mobility wad in our garage. And she's like, I know, but now it's on the internet and I can totally watch it and it's easy, you know? And I knew that that's what we needed. We needed coaching. And I think the second we kind of take away sometimes the coach notion, you know, just it's really hard to coach yourself. You know, you really need is a good coach. Go find a good coach. Make a commitment to coaching each other, but don't fool yourself. You know, you've got to have a coach on all these things, you know, and it's easy. It's cheap. It's out there.
Absolutely. I've definitely taken up a lot of your time, but I wanted to give you a chance. If people are interested in looking you up or coming to see you, anything like that, let them know how to get in touch with you.
Ah, right. So, you know, if you happen to be in San Francisco, you know, we own San Francisco CrossFit. Come bring us your huddled, beat up, trash shoulders. We'll show you that there's always potential to be had. You know, you're having a hard time hitting that, you know, that split jerk, or you want to go faster, you know, come train with our coaches. And then, you know, figure it out. Take a crack at it yourself. Go to mobilitywad.com. You know, there are so many great resources on the internet now. You know, I go to Super Training. I live at Westside. I look at Cressy stuff. And there's just so many really good thinkers, you know, in that you should just, you know, you should make a commitment that once or twice a week you just spend a half hour going around and educate yourself.
Kelly Starr, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.